Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Our friend and colleague Sandra Woodward doesn't only have to get up in the morning long before the rest of us do for her shift on Morning Edition. She's also having her home lifted 8 feet off the ground to get it out of the way of the rising waters of the Chesapeake Bay. We'll talk with Sandra about her experiences living in a FEMA-designated flood zone, but she's not alone. All across Hampton Roads, communities of homes and business owners are struggling to adapt to the challenges presented by rising waters and sinking land. Today, we'll talk with architects and engineers across Hampton Roads who are on the front lines. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. Good Wednesday afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis, and we're glad you're with us today. We're continuing our conversations about sea level rise and the way that our community is adapting and adjusting as a result of it. And all this summer, by the way, we want to hear your stories of the impacts and the effects of sea level rise, land subsidence, recurrent flooding, whatever it is that's affecting you. We've set up an always available hotline called the Coastline, where you can give us a detailed account of how your way of life or your livelihood is being affected by sea level rise. And you can reach the Coastline at 689-7987 or by email at coast-line@whro.org. Today's conversation is a continuation of that whole process. This is something, as you know, if you've listened to this show for any length of time, we started talking about this about 10 years ago when we were looking at the waters coming up and saying, people seem to be growing concerned about this. Perhaps we ought to be talking about it. And since then, lots has happened, but some would say that lots more needs to happen. So we'll talk about what's going on in the region today at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. There has been an effort underway for nearly 2 years now to bring local government staffs together to talk about what they're doing and what they might do together to deal with this challenge. And it is fulsome. Some estimates suggesting that if the current trends continue, we could see more than 5 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. Those estimations change in some respects, but what hasn't changed is the fact that the water's coming up and scientists say it's coming up at a faster rate than we thought it was going to come up, essentially. This region, of course, home to so many military installations, big concern for the Navy, and it's in fact been described as a national security issue as well. So we're talking about it today at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. There's been this Hampton Roads Sea Level Rise Preparedness and Resilience Intergovernmental Planning Pilot Project, because think you get $10 million more for every word you put in the, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Because we'd have a lot of money in that case. Michelle Covey's been very much engaged in that process. She's an assistant professor of practice at ODU in the Department of Ocean, Earth, and Atmospheric Sciences. She's part of the Virginia Sea Grant Extension, and she's been looking at climate change adaptation and coastal resilience specifically around Hampton Roads. Michelle, nice to have you back with us today.
Glad to be back.
So what have you essentially been doing? You have been working a lot to try to engage the public around this issue and find out what people are doing in communities.
Absolutely. And one of the projects that we've had going on, particularly associated with the pilot project, as we call it, has been around trying to find out what citizens really want to happen in the future. So we've done some focus groups. We went up to the area around the Little Creek base and talked to people in those neighborhoods around Norfolk and in Virginia Beach about what they see as the things that they value in their community and the problems that they see confronting.
And what are you hearing about that?
Well, we're hearing that people really value having the base there. They value the community assets like their parks and the beaches. And what they're really worried about is access and being able to get to those things in the future. So we're seeing infrastructure. We're seeing a lot of concerns about homes. And some people even felt that they were being held back from protecting their homes.
Held back how? What do you mean?
By, you know, things like codes that might not allow them to protect their homes. So there's and we know, because we've been dealing with this, that the city of Norfolk and Virginia Beach have actually been encouraging people to make those kinds of changes.
Right.
So there's an education gap as well. So we've been trying to go out and really talk to people about what are the things you really can do that they felt like that they maybe couldn't do in the past. Things are changing.
Are there code issues that need to be adjusted?
Well, that's it's in the process of happening, and there's a lot of conversation. It goes city by city, so we can't talk about a regional code. So you have to kind of look at, in your city, what are the things that you can do? What are the restrictions on you from maybe, you know, is it possible to raise your house? What kind of help are you going to have to raise your house?
See, this strikes me as a very interesting issue, because as we've talked many, many times this broadcast, water doesn't respect city lines. If there's ever a place where you think you could sort of, and I'm not suggesting there isn't regional cooperation, but if there's ever a moment that called for it, this is it. Carol Considine is an associate professor of engineering technology at Old Dominion University, and she's a past chair of the private infrastructure committee for this aforementioned intergovernmental pilot project. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We'll talk about what you're doing, but then I want to come back to this issue of different cities having different codes and how we kind of get there. What is it that you've been working on, really more around resilience?
For the pilot project, though, I think one of the points that you just made is really critical, in that water doesn't know any boundaries. And for the pilot project, we picked that Little Creek Pretty Lake area to kind of highlight how can different communities, municipalities work together to solve problems.
Because Little Creek is right there on the border, Norfolk and Virginia Beach.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that was a great exercise, because I think what we saw in the intergovernmental pilot project, in both the infrastructure working group and the public infrastructure committee, is that the municipalities and private industry are willing to work together to solve these problems. They just have to be provided the opportunities.
Really?
Yes, I believe so.
You believe so? So how is that? I mean,
so a great example is that because of the infrastructure working group on the intergovernmental pilot project, it created relationships between facilities engineers at Little Creek Base, as well as the City of Virginia Beach and City of Norfolk. And they started sharing information about stormwater loading that they hadn't shared before. So by being in a room, discussing a problem, talking about solutions, it creates relationships that allow people to work collaboratively in these areas.
We really noticed that with regard to another issue. We had the emergency planners on some weeks ago because we were talking about the start of hurricane season. And what was very striking to me is that those people have existing relationships that they have nurtured and developed. And they know each other well. They're clearly respectful, appreciative colleagues. And so you just, I don't know, I sort of came away from that show with a sense that, okay, I feel better about this, because these guys do know each other. They're not going to introduce each other when they meet at the flood scene or whatever the emergency is. So that relationship building thing, it seems to me, is really key to this. But let's go back to that regional question. Do you have the sense that a regional sort of strategy, or a regional strategy is not the right word, but some regional norms around zoning so that people know what they can and can't do, should and shouldn't do, would be helpful?
It would be extremely helpful. And if you go look in other, like for example, Southeast Florida, they are creating master plans, and then some of the other municipalities are adopting these ideas. And it would be great if we could create kind of a regional urban water plan and a regional building code that aren't enforced, but that municipalities could adopt because they think they're good ideas. And you're seeing that in New Orleans. In New Orleans, they created an urban water plan for a portion of the parishes that are within the levees. But then the parishes outside the levees are adopting those same ideas, like elevating buildings and using green infrastructure as they develop. And they're adopting those ideas because they're good ideas.
Yeah.
And I think we need those kind of large scale visionary plans here for Hampton Roads.
So what is the holdup for that? Or is this part of a process that that folks would wish would move faster?
I think it's part of a process that everyone wishes would move faster. I think the holdup is money. I think that what came out of the intergovernmental pilot project is that the Hampton Roads Planning District Commission is going to start taking a lead on kind of this regional sea level rise planning. And so hopefully they'll start looking for money to come up with some of these larger scale plans for adaptation for the region.
We're at 15 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Leo's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I am 22 years old, and I just recently graduated from ODU with a bachelor's of science. And I just wanted to make a statement that I'm really fearful that when I am 70 or 80 years old, that I'm not going to have a university to come back to because of sea level rise. And thinking about the Hampton Roads area and the Eastern Shore, I don't think a lot of people realize that within the next 50 to 100 years, we could be losing that to the ocean. And I want all the listeners to know that are educated on the issues, we need to come together and educate the public more on these issues so they know the risk that's involved, and so that we can bring the state of Virginia and the nation together to fight against these issues.
Leo, thanks for the call. And this is an interesting point. Leo's talking about fighting against the issues. What we are increasingly now talking about is adapting to the issues, which is sort of a different scenario.
Absolutely. We talk about living with water. We talk about thriving with water. We talk about coming up with these innovative solutions and selling those solutions to the world, because we're kind of at the front lines of making these changes. We're one of the places that's sinking the fastest. Well, waters are rising the fastest. So we're poised in this region to be the innovators and come up with the solutions. And we have students at many of our universities that are starting to learn these skills.
Leo, thank you for the call. We're glad to have Mason Andrews with us today, back with us, Associate Professor of Architecture at Hampton University. And she's the co-founder of the Coastal Community Design Collaborative, which is a very interesting program that brings together Hampton University and Old Dominion Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering to look at communities and come up with just what we've been talking about in response to Leo's call, for which I thank you, Leo, which has to do with adaptation strategies. Mason, nice to have you back with us today.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
When you heard Leo's call, I think this is sometimes where we get to this subject, right? Somebody was just commenting on our Facebook page that their response is that they are leaving the region and moving to Lexington.
We will miss them. But for those those of us who consider this their home,
yeah,
we all perhaps are going to face our personal ends, and I don't think it is predictable how long we'll last here.
But you don't,
we can certainly live out, have a long and happy future together here.
Well, just beyond 50 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Brian wrote that. He said he's just one of the reasons they're relocating to Lexington, which is 2,200 feet above sea level. Not to mention, he says, we're due for a big hurricane and don't want to boat to our Red Mill South location. So apparently he is already starting to see effects of sea level rise when gravity no longer drains water out of the neighborhood just a couple of feet above the current level, they'll have water filling up their neighborhood as well. So a lot of people watching what's going on in Norfolk. Brian's one of them. Not everybody's certainly planning to pull up stakes and leave, but you've been doing some really interesting projects, certainly in the Chesterfield Heights community.
Yes. And we've
done a show on that before, but I wonder for our listeners who unbelievably aren't listening every single day, if you would remind us of that project.
Certainly. We are a sort of bootstraps operation. We didn't have a clue what we were doing, but it seemed like a good idea to go try to help.
How refreshing, that degree of candor.
So some architecture students and I went in with Wetlands Watch to the wonderful community of Chesterfield Heights and started talking to people. And we learned a lot of things, and we began to develop a few adaptation strategies. So, as it happens, Old Dominion and my colleague in crime, Mujda Ertnunal, They came into the project. We did some modeling and discovered we could keep them dry for the next 100 years under current predictions, doing some pretty simple, straightforward green infrastructure. They have good soil up there. Not all of Hampton Roads does, but that means we can collect water and hold it and let it recharge the groundwater after storm events have passed, because, of course, one of our big reasons for flooding is that a majority of our stormwater outfalls, where the water from street drains runs back in out into the river or bay, are now below water.
Right.
So they're acting as conduits. So the flooding is coming from the sky, but it's also coming up through the stormwater
system. Seems to be, my own observation is that any of the areas that, if you've lived here for a while, you know are regular flooding areas, mm-hmm. are flooding faster.
Mm-hmm. It's true. We're getting more rain than we used to, and the sea level is blocking more outfall. So
yeah.
This is a regularly occurring event, and there are things that we as individuals can do, property owners, which is try to keep the water that falls on our parcel, on that parcel. That's a key component of our work in Chesterfield Heights. But if you just think about it, if there's not water running off of properties, what's in the street is just what's in the street, which probably means you don't have to take refuge in a 7-Eleven parking lot.
Which happens to any amount of us from time to time. So when you say there are things we can do as individual homeowners, what are some of those things that you see that we could be doing?
Instead of piping rainfall runoff into the street, pipe it into a cistern or a rain garden. And that's fairly straightforward.
And that's something that's not requiring any sort of extra expenditure except for homeowners, right?
Right. And that goes back to kind of these regional building codes. If you, for all new buildings, if you said you have to collect the rainwater on your site and release it later, that would address these same issues. And it's an excellent solution, and we should be moving in those directions.
And I don't say that it all sounds complex to me, but fairly easy in the scheme of things, right? I mean, that's sort of a public campaign. That's regional planning and suggestions that cities adopt of sort of Mike left us. He wanted to know about that very question, which is, to what degree are we having a moment where we have a regional plan?
I don't think we're there yet. I think we're working in that direction. And I think, you know, I think these types of discussions can help us move in that direction. I think we're seeing a lot of action in the city of Norfolk. I think they're being very progressive. I think other cities are watching what they're doing and are going to start adopting some of their methods. The city of Norfolk is, through their NFWF grant, is having a National Fish and Wildlife Federation grant, is having a website developed for homeowners that's going to show different best management practices for stormwater,
yeah.
including rain gardens, cisterns, rain barrels. So I think, you know, I think we're seeing movement. But again, I think, it's, you know, it's going to take a little bit more time.
Forgive me for pressing this question, but for 2 years now, and we're not killing any messengers sitting around this table. I'm just trying to bring us to a point of a moment here. For more than 2 years, we've been having a conversation about the fact that we are poised as a region to be developing these technologies and selling these technologies. We've just talked in this broadcast about some really interesting, pretty simple, relatively speaking, ideas and things that we could model. And I think all of you have said some version of, it'd be great if we had a regional water plan. It'd be great if we had a plan that we came up with that wasn't through some sort of regional government, but that was posed to the cities to be able to say, hey, could we all get on board with this? I'm wondering what it feels like if the waters are rising and the land is sinking, and we've been working hard for 2 years, what's the holdup there?
Well, each of the cities is different. Remember, not everybody is having this effect to the same degree. And so there are places, there are neighborhoods where you could walk in there and say, hey, you know, do you know that it's flooding in this region? And they'll say, I don't see flooding.
Yeah, it's not in my yard, so I don't see it. Sure, and that's a perfectly human response, isn't it?
And so they may say, yeah. I would rather, if this is going to be an expensive solution, I'd rather you spend it on this thing instead of that thing. So
I think another piece directly related to what you're saying, and I'm not trying to shoot the legs out from underneath the war horse mm-hmm. you're on, but what we've discovered is that every neighborhood is different. The soil mm-hmm. conditions are different. The water, the terrain, it's different. And just if you get everybody in the same room from all those different communities, the solutions aren't going to be the same.
Got it.
I think drilling down to the point at which you can have impact on a particular place that's got particular conditions may prove to be more useful than the big room with a big conference table.
So even if you had then a regional water policy that you would pose back, that might be one strategy, but in fact every community might have its own unique strategies that would be appropriate for that community.
Yes.
So very interesting, because I remember a thousand years ago we were talking about, it was a thousand years ago, so it was right before the O2 transportation referendum. That's how long ago that was. And I remember a man calling from Virginia Beach who said a variation of exactly what you said, Michelle. He said, look, I live on fill-in-the-blank road. There are these projects you all are talking about. I have no trouble getting where I need to go, and I don't see this, and so I don't want to pay for it. So, you know, these are realities that we have to take into account if we are to sort of collectively think through these big problems. Fair enough.
And yet our economies are all intertwined. We rise and float together as a region based on the kind of industries that are here. People are working. If you look at the maps that show where people live versus where people work, people are not staying in that one city.
Yeah.
So it's important to understand that we are interlinked economically.
It's a fair enough point. I think, and somebody will correct me on this, I count on that, dear listeners. I think it's something, and believe me, y'all never fail to let me know when I'm wrong. I think it's something on the order of 60% or so of people in the region live in one city, work in another. Mm-hmm. So it's something along those lines. So you're right, we're crossing these boundaries every day. We're glad to have on the line with us Sheldon Merrill, who is studying architecture at Hampton University and contributed to this collaborative venture between students from HU and ODU to look at mitigating dangerous flooding. She particularly worked in the area around the Hague section of Norfolk. Sheldon Merrill, good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You're welcome. So tell us what you did for the Hague project, and describe sort of what you all were up against, if you will.
Yeah, like Mason was saying, we're really looking at different areas in the community about how we can adapt to the high tide and the amount of rainfall. So we really looked at two different scales. We looked at a small scale, which is just looking at sponge solutions, how we can store water, how we can start looking at a lot of the asphalt and how they can be permeable materials so that you're really soaking in the water, and also on a homeowner's aspect of how they can do rooftop solutions to store water on their own property. And then we looked at a larger scale, which is what we called barriers, which are just looking at ways to, wall solutions, especially on the Hague, as a way to kind of hold back the tide, to give them time to brace for the large amounts of water that is going into the area or the neighborhoods as well. And really, we're learning a lot of how we learn or gathering the information is really working in a collaborative environment, learning from the neighbors, what they're experiencing, what's going on in their homes, their basements, their cars, and then also working with local professionals and just getting their input to see if our design thought process is on the right track and can actually be a solution that would really benefit the community. So getting different soil bearings, looking at what are actually creek beds and filled areas. So they help us guide our design as well.
And you're working in an area that I think, Mason, was a creek originally, right? It was sort of filled in. And
yes.
So this, none of this should actually shock us in retrospect, right?
Yeah.
This must be a very interesting experience, Sheldon Merrill, to sort of looking at the architecture of it, but then also testing these solutions and talking with neighbors to see how they may fit or what they're experiencing.
Yeah, I think it's a very beneficial experience because I think the big thing about architecture is that we design based on, we want to make their environment more welcoming and more productive. And so a lot of how you do great design is listening and getting the input of the different neighbors around, because they're the ones living in those communities. So we really look at, okay, so we have to have a solution of you know, controlling the high tide or the amount of rainfall. But like the Hague is also a place where a lot of people are, you know, walk daily or jog or go to the park. And so how do we still allow that part to be intact, as well as looking at different solutions to withstand the rain flood? So it's like adapting but still keeping the character of the environment.
I love that. I love that approach. Sheldon Merrill, where are you at Hampton University right now in terms of your education? Are you about to graduate, or you just what's your story?
The last year I was a fourth year architect major, so I'll be a fifth year graduate student. So we're doing thesis work next year.
Oh boy.
I have 1 year left, yeah.
Yay. And I wonder how this experience has shaped your future plans.
Really it's just the experience that Mason gives us, and like really looking at different aspects, like what architecture is on different levels. So like working with other people, being able to communicate your idea. So I think really working with the engineers just allows you to see a more well-rounded architect.
Yeah.
And you know, working with the community, getting their input and making sure that's incorporated in the design, and then also really working with engineers and having that relationship and how you can really work, because we think differently. So that's another tackle, is how can you take different disciplines and really work together to make one solution. So I feel like I think this experience has just allowed me to be a more better designer and really think outside the box. And I think I really want to be successful, and I have, and architecture to be a really craft that I do well at. And so this, I think, has been something that has been very beneficial in that.
And I wonder, do you see yourself working in the sea level arena from an architectural perspective when you finish this process and graduate?
I definitely could see it as something that I would like to dive into and work with. I think it's I think it's something that a lot of people are starting to get a lot of interest in.
Yeah.
So, you know, really kind of being in the forefront of that would be really awesome. And
a lot
of our students are doing that as well.
It's not an insignificant thing to come out of Hampton University Architecture School with actual project work that's actually making a difference and that's been funded and gotten all kinds of awards. That's not a shabby way to depart from Hampton University.
Not at all.
Sheldon Merrill, thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Take care.
Shelley, you already got an A for next semester.
Oh, wow. I like it. And I entirely support that. Sheldon Merrill, an architecture student at Hampton University in her master's program. We're at 28 minutes before the hour. Jack's on the line from Matthews County. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hello, ladies. I'm honored to be in your presence. I want to shout out to Mason Andrews. Mason and I were Oyster Crusaders some 20 years ago. Oysters in the Chesapeake Bay.
Hi, Captain Jack. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I am now an elected official in Matthews County, and I'm up to my eyeballs in floods and flood policy. Just a few off-the-cuff remarks. First, there is a uniform effort as far as the state uniform building code, which they're in the process of revising right now, and they have numerous flood provisions in there, freeboard requirements, VE building code requirements for the Limois or Coastal A zone. And so there is a uniform guidance. The one thing I wanted to remark with respect to what Mason was talking about is that the experiences are very, very localized, whether it's soil conditions, whether the amount of sea level rise in a given location, whether what the rate of subsidence is. Presently, Skip Skiles and Wetlands Watch is working with Norfolk. You'll have the greatest level of subsidence and measured sea level rise. It is a fraction of what we're experiencing in Matthews County.
So
I would urge you all to be mindful of the fact of there are unintended consequences of some of the things that we do.
Like what?
And I'm a big proponent of voluntary requirements. Mm-hmm. I believe that anything that we're building new, we should put freeboard, which is added elevation to anticipate flooding, staying out of the high wave action areas so that the wave action doesn't damage our structures.
Yeah.
However, when we codify these matters, what happens is that the houses that were built under a different code are no longer compliant. They are grandfathered, but they are not compliant. And the fear is that this opens up the door for possibly having mortgages called, insurance canceled, things of that nature.
Yeah, and Jack, it's a very interesting point. And some of the things that you're raising are the ones that are being dealt with at the College of William & Mary in their
Coastal Policy Institute.
Thank you, Morgan, who's always in my ear and my brain. Coastal Policy Institute, because these are decisions that if we make them, we'll have long-term consequence. And it's really important that we understand that so that we mitigate the number of unintended consequences. Jack, I thank you for the call. Jack brings up a great point that it's going to be different for every region. So maybe the idea is to get a range of options and then let each community consider the degree to which they're interested in signing up.
Well, I agree. And that's what's great about these plans is that you can come up with model plans that people can decide whether to adopt or not. And once you have these plans, you can start looking at what are the financial impacts, how can you incentivize people to take action to adapt their properties? How can you incentivize people to move out of an area that could eventually be someplace where we could store flood water and be used for recreation when we're not having an event? What we need to be thinking about is more long-term.
Yeah.
Long-term planning, and how are we going to change how Hampton Roads is used so that we have areas that can thrive in business, areas that can allow water to come in and leave and can be used for recreation, and start making those decisions to move forward.
And that's a piece of this whole planning process. So
yes.
I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Mason Andrews, congratulations on a great program, co-venture between Hampton and Old Dominion. If Sheldon Merrill is any indication, you are doing some excellent work there. So thank you for being with us today. Michelle Covey, thank you for being with us, and thank you for sticking at the table and, you know, getting all these people together so we can talk about what works and what we might pursue going forward. Carol Considine, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing on this intergovernmental pilot project and really looking at the ways we could shift our infrastructure to accommodate what's coming. And Jack, I thank you for the call that reminds us that Hampton Roads is diverse and unique and wonderful in so many ways. And so each community's options will be different, and each community's expectations and experiences will be different as well. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk with our own good friend, Sandra Woodward. I think she's still awake, actually, which is amazing, considering the hour at which she rises to keep us informed on Morning Edition. We'll get her own personal experience of sea level rise in just a moment. Coming up on 20 minutes before 1 o'clock. Awfully glad to have you with us today. We're talking about sea level rise, and we're glad to have Sandra Woodward with us in the studio today. I joke about you still being awake, but we've had lunch many times after the show, so I should have a little joke because you are very much awake.
I am.
Awake and ready to
Fascinating
go.
Fascinating show.
Yeah. What time do you have to get up in the morning to get here?
I get up at 3.
Wow.
I show up here about 4:15.
Nice.
So. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Really awesome.
And so nobody's out on the streets when you're
you
out
would be
except the other early morning people.
Because, you know, I live near the base. I live off Hampton yeah. Boulevard, which I guess we're going to get into here in a second. But you'd be surprised how busy Hampton Boulevard is at 4
sure.
in the morning.
You know, and it's interesting because some years ago, I think this is still the case, we were something like the Hampton Roads generally, largely because of the military, was something like the third earliest rising community in the country.
Believe it.
And, of course, that means our newspaper hits our deck earlier than it does in other communities and all the rest of it. Well, you live in a home that is right at the water's edge, a beautiful home. How long have you owned your home?
11 years. It's near the Lafayette River. And, you know, it's interesting. I was listening, obviously, uh-huh. the first part of this show, and people talking about different regions and the issues that face the neighborhood. My neighborhood, the majority of the homes were built in the late 50s. Mine was built in 1959 on fill dirt. And this is, you know, one of those areas. It was a swamp. They brought fill dirt in, and they built some houses on it. And I feel like I should say, too, that my opinions expressed here on this show are in no way representative right. of anything here at WHRV.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of one of those things that, you know, should they have built those houses there? Hard to say. And we are sinking fast. Since I've lived in that house, we've had the elevation certificate from when we bought the house and the elevation certificate that they just did. Our house has sunk an entire foot.
Wow. That's amazing.
There, so.
And so you got to be part of this program. Well, tell us about that.
It's a three-party program. I had to sign a three-party contract with FEMA, with the Virginia Department of Emergency Management, and the City of Norfolk, and me. and this has been going on for about a decade, I think. They've elevated approximately 30 homes. And we're one of those that they're working on. We're in the middle of it right now. And it's usually tied into an event. So meaning that Isabel, for instance, elevated the first home in my block across the street from me. Irene, all of those, they're usually tied into an event. The city gets a bunch of money or FEMA gives, you know, they mm-hmm. we file for what do they call it? Declaration, emergency declaration.
Yes.
And money starts coming in. And then the city applies to get some of that money to elevate some homes. Usually they're in a package of homes, you know, five homes here, two homes here, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. It goes, you have to, as a homeowner, submit your argument for why your home should be eligible for this program. It has to do with a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
How many times is your home flooded? How much did it cost you to fix that home? All of those things. And if you end up qualifying, then you get thrown in for one of these programs. We've waited for this for 10 years.
Wow.
That's how long.
Wow.
We actually went through the program once and then turned it down because, you know, one thing about this program is since the majority of the money that goes into it comes from the federal government or from the city government or from the state, a certain amount is the homeowner's responsibility. You do not get a choice of who your contractor is. That is something that goes out for bid mm-hmm. and the city. And that, you know, your previous guests were talking about how it varies from region to region. That's true here, too. The city of Norfolk goes with lowest bidder. Other cities may not go with that. So when we went through the program the first time around, we actually turned it down because the person who won the bid, the contractor who won the bid, had never done a brick home, and that made us really nervous.
Mm.
So we backed away, and our house flooded between then and now. So that was a risk that we took. The contractor that won the bid this time has actually done the majority of the homes on our block. We're thrilled with them, and they started 2 weeks ago.
Wow. So how high will your, so what will they do? What are they doing to your house?
The first thing they do is they do something called shooting the door, which means that a bunch of people come out, engineers and so forth, and they do a survey and elevation to see where your door, front door is, and then they compare it to what FEMA wants it to be to meet the 100-year flood plain level, which mm-hmm. doesn't have anything to do with 100 years. It has to do with the percentage chance of your home flooding within a year and the following year and how much worse it's going to get.
Yeah.
And then they make decisions. Those are decisions that FEMA makes as to how high your home is going to be. So in our case, our home has gone up 8 feet.
Wow.
They haven't built the new foundation yet. I have pictures that I gave Morgan, and I think you posted
We're
one on you.
Them.
Yeah.
And by we, I mean Morgan.
Yeah,
just
course.
To be clear.
They basically it's a very violent act. I've joked that it's like, you know, they say you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. They beat the heck out of your home, put a bunch of holes in it, put a bunch of steel beams in, hook up a bunch of pneumatic jacks, jack that baby up. It takes about a day for the, it took them 2 days actually to jack it up 8 feet. Now the concrete guys are on site. They have been for the last week and will be for the next week. And they're pouring concrete and they're building a concrete foundation that's called a waffle foundation, which is what they have found that works best in the full dirt situation where the land is always subsiding.
Ah.
Because even though our house is going to be up 8 feet, it's still going to be sinking.
It's still going to be sinking, right.
Mm-hmm. It's still going to sink for the next however many years. And so the way they do the foundation, they pour it, it's designed to sink evenly. What I have right now, you could go skiing in my house right now if you wanted to. There's so many hills because it's been sinking unevenly for the last decade.
So was there ever a point where you said, this is a great house, but really, we got to get, let's just move on?
Only probably every day since I bought it.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of those things too where, you know, no one, and I don't want to, this is totally my responsibility. I bought this house. I know what I, you know, but yeah. No one tells people this stuff because no one really knows how to deal with it. You know, they.
And back then, frankly, my realtor, we weren't talking about
11
it
years
much.
Ago, not really. I mean, the water was coming up. People had trouble getting up and down the street. But, you know, you can pull FEMA records on any house you buy. And I would say this to any homeowner that gets locked in. If you fall in love with an A4 flood zone house, pull the records on it. Take a look at how many times it flooded, you know, and make decisions on that. I've had 2 feet of water in my house 3 times in the last 10 years. And, you know, if I hadn't bought the house with that, and I would feel terrible. And no one told me when I bought the house. My lawyers didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. The real estate agent didn't say anything. And it keeps happening. Our next door neighbors, they just moved in. Very nice military family. Guy's on a submarine. He's from California. Had no idea. Now, granted, their house is elevated. But they had no idea that the street floods like it does. No one told them.
Wow.
No clue. Their first week
really
moving in. Had no idea.
Wow. So we've got the pictures, by the way, of Sandra's house that's getting a lift, being lifted 8 feet. So you can check that out on our Facebook page. We're at 14 minutes before the hour. What questions do you have about this process from a homeowner's perspective of elevating one's home? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. There's this term freeboard, which typically is used to describe how far up off the ground we're going to put buildings.
I have not. I've been hanging out with the guys who've been doing my house. I haven't heard them use that name yet. I've used that exact terminology.
But 8 feet was what they determined in your case.
Based on what FEMA wants and where my house was sitting, it's gone up 8 feet. Once it's up that high, they're going to have to build the actual foundation. They're going to set it back down.
Yeah.
And when they set it back down, that's when they determine exactly what they do. They reshoot the door again to make sure it's right. And if it's right, I get a new elevation certificate and my flood insurance goes away.
Yay. Hey. And that's not a small factor. In fact, we've got some folks commenting on our Facebook page about that very piece of the story.
No shame in admitting I pay $4,000 a year in flood insurance.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
440-2665, 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. We're talking about sea level rise, wondering how that is affecting you, and you can certainly give us a call. Melissa writes, I'm listening to the show, just saw the post. Thanks for the picture. It's nice to have a visual. So that's there for your viewing pleasure. Chuck writes about a house that he bought in the same Kempsville neighborhood where his parents have lived since 1979. He had grown up there, dreamed of buying a home in that neighborhood, did it, used the same insurance company, uses for everything else the last 20 years, but they wouldn't write the policy because of a new flood zone. So he says, as kids, we rode out all of these storms without ever seeing a puddle deeper than my ankle. But because I'm a stone's throw from the Elizabeth River, had a hard time finding a homeowner's policy. So will the insurance industry eventually refuse to cover home sales in Hampton Roads? We're working on a show, as a matter of fact, about the insurance piece of this, because that's an incredibly important part of this story.
And it's a mess, actually. When you the flood insurance program is essentially broken. I mean, for reasons like that, but also, you know, a lot of people don't realize just because you have flood insurance doesn't mean it makes anything better. If your house floods, flood insurance only pays to put things back the way it was. So, for instance, we spent a lot of money because we had flooded a couple of times, turning part of the house that flooded continuously into a swimming pool. We had it tiled. We had all the electric put up 4 feet up the wall, so every time it flooded, we wouldn't have such a high claim every time. But flood insurance doesn't help you with that. That comes
That's
out
you.
Of your pocket.
Right, right, right. You know, the other thing, and this is some of the issues that the Coastal Policy Institute is working on at the College of William & Mary, has to do with people like you. For example, you said your house will continue to sink. So how do we go about mortgaging these these homes with a limited lifespan. So we buy homes and we get mortgages and we purchase these homes. Maybe we get a 30-year mortgage and the expectations is somebody that's going to come in behind us and get another 30-year mortgage and on it goes. So how do we go about arranging financing for homes that may have a more limited but certainly beautiful life for 50 years, but maybe not beyond 50 years?
Well, I mean, that's part of the, you know, in deciding when we were decided to take part in this program, this gets back to what I said about the flood insurance program too, but this FEMA program, they are helping me pay to put my home out of harm's way. They're not paying to make it any better.
Right.
So part of the program is they put stairs to all your new doorways. So I'm going to have new 8 feet stairs, okay, which aesthetically doesn't look very good. So if you want to make it look good landscaping wise, yeah, perhaps a nice patio instead of just a pair of some stairs going up, that's out of your pocket
too.
Got it.
These are important things to know. Deborah's on the line from Newport News. Hi, Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a comment / question.
Okay.
With a great deal of empathy for the people whose houses are flooding.
Sure.
I still have some reservations about FEMA dollars, which is really my tax dollars,
right,
and yours, going to continuously bail out properties that are clearly never going to be stable. I mean,
yeah,
you know, that you said it's continuing to sink, even though they're jacking it up 8 feet. I mean, dropping a whole foot in a decade, which is,
yeah,
what I understood,
mm-hmm,
that's not likely to continue to be successful. And I'm wondering whether the money could be spent more, I don't know, more productively and maybe in a more egalitarian way rather than bailing out houses that are, you know, in zones that just aren't really,
sure,
going to work.
And
at
Deborah,
what point do we say it's enough?
Yeah. And Deborah, I think you've expressed that compassionately, eloquently, and forcefully, and I thank you for that. That is exactly the question a lot of people ask in the wake of New Orleans when they went back and fixed the bowl, right? You get it, right?
All the time.
Yeah.
And the thing I would say about this is I agree. If the city had come to me, or if FEMA came to me and said, you know what, and actually I should clarify, FEMA has nothing to do with homeowners. It all goes through the state and the city. So I deal with the city, not with FEMA. FEMA doesn't give money to homeowners directly at all. If the city come to me and said, you know what, let's give these houses back to the Bay. We're going to buy out all the houses, let the city take it back, or like I think one of your guests earlier had mentioned, making it a reservoir for floodwaters,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing, make it recreational. I'm all for it, but good luck talking all 25 people that are in my particular block into giving up their homes. I would have been game for something like that,
yeah,
but not everybody's going to be. It's a very personal thing, you know.
Sure.
I found it, especially with this, watching them beat the heck out of my home to do this to my house. You'd be amazed. I was surprised at how upset I got watching that happen. You become very attached to your home, and asking people to give up their homes is a tough thing to do. But I agree with her completely.
Yeah.
I think it probably, in some cases, might be a better thing.
We should note as well, Deborah, and this gets at that question of how you go about approaching this when you're talking about a property that we all readily acknowledge is probably not going to be habitable in 50 years.
I would argue it never should have been built there to begin with.
Okay.
Like I said, they've trucked in a bunch of fill dirt, built these houses because people need someplace to live. As you've said, this is Navy Town. We've got tons of people. I've got a submariner living right next to me. Most of the people I know in my neighborhood are with military. So where are they going to live?
Yeah.
We're going to give all these houses back to the water, so we're not spending money. So where are we going to put all these people?
Well, and the other point, Deborah, and I think this is the argument that some make around these kinds of efforts,
yeah,
is that your house, if it is overtaken by the water, will, mm-hmm, not be generating any taxes.
And well,
you now pay taxes, you pay real estate,
right,
taxes, and
that's the other
and
thing,
and all the rest. So I think that
it's an
argument is around the tax base. And in a city like Norfolk, where a lot of the waterfront property maintains a pretty strong tax base in an otherwise fiscally stressed city, that's a factor to consider.
Absolutely.
But your point is absolutely well taken, because the reality is some of these places, there will need to be a strategic retreat decision made.
Exactly.
And, you know, Paul Frame just finishing his tenure as mayor. That's something that he, I would say, a lot of people said pretty courageously put out there early on to say, hey, we're going to have that conversation about strategic,
mm-hmm,
retreat. It's not a happy conversation, but reality is reality. So there's some areas where we're going to have to kind of figure that out. And for the rest of it, we're going to have some innovative solutions that will allow us to maximize the use of these places for the time frame that we have, and then right. then be done with them.
Right. And so, you know, and part of that as a homeowner, you know, dealing with this every day, believe me, you know, you learn to live with tide charts and, you know, hurricane season comes around and I'm always constantly gritting my teeth and not sleeping because I don't know if this is going to be the big one. Is this mm-hmm. the one's going to take the house, you know? And then I think, okay, well, we just get out and sell it. Well, who do I sell it to? I, in good conscience, could not sell that house, honestly, to someone. I just couldn't. It doesn't. It's just the way I am. And so we made
Well, and it doesn't even, and that's great for you. But I mean, it's if you, all somebody would have to do is pull a record and say, oh, okay,
but how many people yeah. do that? I mean, I don't think people know to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a very good point. That's a very good, particularly people who are new to the region don't know.
Like I said, our next door neighbors from California, no clue. No clue
yeah.
that they were moving into an A4 zone, which is interesting because in an A4 zone or an AE zone, as they call it now, you have to get flood insurance if your home isn't elevated. Now that they're elevating all these homes, the flood insurance requirement's going away.
Very interesting. 5 minutes before the hour, and we're thank you for the call, Deborah. I think you raised a very important question mm-hmm. that all of us need to think about, really, because you're right. The FEMA money, that's all our money. The city money, that's all our money. You know, at the end of the day, this
right.
is sort of a collective decision. I thank you for the call. Don's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is if your house is settling unevenly, typically mm-hmm. there's some structural damage to the home when you level it. Does FEMA cover the cost of that, or have you looked at that?
I will answer that question for you, and the answer is no. When you the house is elevated under this program, you have to sign a waiver after you make the decision whether you want it to set it back down unevenly, which they will do, or if you decide to set it down evenly, which they will do too, anything that goes wrong with that, and actually, if I don't know if Morgan posted the picture.
He's just getting ready to post
a picture,
now.
A picture with a giant crack that has developed after they elevated it. Once they set it back down, it may close up. We won't know until they set it down on the new foundation. But that's part of this program too, I should mention, when I talk about programs that maybe are not quite as they need to work on it, is one thing with this program is if they were to elevated my house, for instance, and found that a bunch of the frame had rotted. It didn't. Thank goodness we had a great house from that standpoint. FEMA does not pay for you to fix that. So if you cannot afford to fix all that rot on your frame, they're going to set that house back down on the new foundation with a rotted frame.
Wow. Don, thank you for the call. Where are you living in the meantime, by the way?
Well, that's another thing. Everybody thinks this is a free lunch. It's not. You have to move out and live somewhere.
Yeah.
So rent a house. So you're paying a mortgage and paying for rent as
so
well.
So you're not getting any compensation for
no,
that?
No, FEMA used to compensate about 10 years ago. They used to compensate from what I heard about $50 a day, but there is no longer any compensation whatsoever.
Wow. So, in retrospect,
yes.
What's your take on this? Hindsight being 2020.
I love my house.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that.
Yeah. Okay. Fair
house.
Enough. And you remember that, don't you? Right?
Keep telling yeah. myself
Keep
that every
telling
day.
Telling yourself that. There you go. Wow. Sandra Woodward, thank you so much for being with us today. Best of continued success.
Thank you.
And, you know, I really appreciate the human side of that story because, you know, it's easy to talk about elevations and all the rest of it. But until you really look at this from the perspective of somebody who's facing it, you don't really have the full story. Speaking of the full story, we're looking for stories like Sandra's on the impacts of sea level rise and land subsidence. The coastline is available to you at 689-7987, 689-7987, or you can email coast-line@whro.org, coast-line@whro.org. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Dr. Phyllis Newman will be here to answer all of your pet questions. So, get them ready now because they usually have full lines for that whole show. Thanks so much for your thoughts and your calls today. This is a conversation we're going to continue to have as a community. We're going to try to figure out how to package this expertise in a way that's marketable and try to figure out some strategies that as a region we can take a look at and see where we go from here. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.